Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Of all of our founding fathers held in the highest regard, Thomas Jefferson stands tall, but the differences between his public stance on slavery and his ownership of hundreds of slaves adds another dimension. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. But first, it's our pleasure to welcome Missouri Democratic Senator Claire McCaskill to our studio. Congress is in hiatus at the moment, and the senator and her colleagues in both houses are back in their home states and districts, finding out what constituents have on their minds. Senator, welcome. I'll bet you you're getting an earful.
I am. But it is, frankly, an important time of year because when you're not running back and forth to Washington, you have a chance to move around the state and talk to people and, more importantly, listen. So it's. I think it's very, very helpful. It keeps your perspective where it needs to be.
What are you hearing?
Well, it depends. I hear some good news about housing, particularly housing recovery. I've met with some of the particularly realtors and home builders that are feeling much better about that foundational part of our economy. A lot of insecurity and, frankly, misinformation about the health care reforms that are looming. And what is it going to be like in a state where the state legislature has done everything in its power to make this program fail for Missourians? And a lot of frustration that people have. I'm somebody who hangs out in the middle in Washington. Sometimes I get chewed on by both the far left and the far right. I'm okay with that. I just wish more people would hang out in the middle with me, because if they would, we could get compromises done. And ultimately, that's what makes a democracy work, is the art of compromise. It's not rigid ideology. People are most Missourians, I think, agree with that. And when I talk to them in their businesses or even in the grocery store, they say, why can't you guys just figure out a way to sit down and, find a way to compromise?
You know, that's what I wanted to bring up, and then we can dismiss it, because I know you're getting it, and everybody who's serving in the Congress now is getting it, this overwhelming frustration with the inability to get things done and to work together. I mean, it's really beginning to wear everybody down.
It is. Now, I do want to give some historical perspective. There has never been a time in our history where the House has been controlled by one party, the Senate controlled by another party, where they've held hands and sing Kumbaya. The House members believe they have been sent with a certain set of priorities that are much different than the majority of the Senate believes. So that the way our founding fathers set up our country, they envisioned that possibility. And that means it's even more difficult. And particularly with a presidential campaign now looming, an open presidency, we've got a number of folks in the Senate that are positioning themselves to try to run for president. And they are trying to appeal to the same swath of voters that are, frankly, the most extreme voters in the Republican Party. So they have been more than happy to hang their hat on the peg of rigid ideology because they think it helps their presidential politics. And that makes it even more difficult for us to we've done some good bipartisan work in the Senate. It generally gets waylaid in the House. But even now we're having trouble in the Senate because of just a few people who are trying to position themselves for a run for president.
Isn't there another element, however, Senator, that goes back to 2008 and the election of this president, a black president? Doesn't that play into this equation?
Well, I think that certainly the success that President Obama had in 2008, first we had success in 2006, the Democrats taking the Senate, and then the success in 2008, and then, of course, the really visceral reaction of the country in 2010, that was a combination of the economic morass we found ourselves in. It's very hard for anybody to vote for the current party if they're losing their paycheck or they think they're losing their paycheck or if their house is being foreclosed on. And so we elected in that election some folks that I think thought they were being told to go and shut the government down. But what they in reality they were being told is we don't like the way things are going right now. So all of that mixes together with and the 24-hour news cycle and the politics of today, it makes it harder and harder for us to elect moderates because moderates have a hard time finding their way through their primaries. And that is, I don't think, bodes well for the future if we can't get back to celebrating moderates in both parties.
So you think it's less of an issue of this president at this time?
I think it's that the Republicans wanted to defeat him politically and they thought obstructionism would work. Now, ironically, we did much better in 12. We elected more Democrats to the Senate in 12, not less.
And more women.
And more women. Mm-hmm. And the president, of course, was reelected by a significant margin. So I don't think the obstructionism worked for them politically. And now the obstructionism may not be as much of a political calculation as the reality of everything else that's going on.
You have come out in support of Hillary Clinton while we're talking politics for the next cycle in 2014. Do you have any sense that she is ready to run? I mean, there's some question in a lot of minds as to whether she actually will.
Well, I'm hopeful. And frankly, that's the reason I did it. I did it because I'm trying to do everything I can to encourage her to run. I think she is uniquely qualified and uniquely situated. If anybody would have told me 20 years ago that there would be a time that the presidency would be open and my party wouldn't have a primary, I'd say, well, you're smoking something that's probably illegal because Hillary Clinton is uniquely positioned, I believe, to get the nomination without a significant primary fight, which I think puts our party at a tremendous advantage in terms of winning the presidency. And besides that, she, I think, is by far the most qualified candidate for president that has even that is even being contemplated at this point.
Who's number two if she decides not to run?
I think there's a number of people out there that will run. Certainly the vice president, I think, will be the most obvious person that may throw their hat in the ring. Vice President Biden, I think, would is thinking about it. There's governors around the country that are thinking about it. Martin O'Malley has certainly made no bones about it. The governor of Maryland that he wants to run. I think Deval Patrick up in Massachusetts has made signals that he is interested in running. I don't know who would end up on the playing field if she, but she's keeping everyone aside right now. No one is moving towards a presidential campaign until Hillary Clinton decides.
It's not like there isn't a little time left before these decisions have to be made. Let's talk about some things that are going on in other parts of the world right now. We're all watching with great horror what we've been seeing coming out of Syria. What's your take on this poison gas report that we've been getting and these awful videos of people dying, children among them, women, of course? Are we being decisive enough in dealing with the situation in Syria today and also in Egypt? Mubarak is home today. Are we taking the right course in that part of the world?
It's really difficult. I know that the very best minds in both military and foreign policy are applying themselves to these problems and doing the very best. What we don't want to do is embolden our enemies and, most importantly, arm our enemies. So in Syria, it's been very tricky because it's been difficult to tell who is in charge of the opposition forces. Al-Qaeda has certainly moved into a vacuum all over the Middle East where there are these fledgling democracies. They have tried to come in and assert themselves. No question that our enemy was part of some of the opposition forces that we saw in Syria. So I think the reluctance was not that we didn't want to help remove Assad, but rather the unintended consequences of coming in a way that wasn't really thoughtful and strategic. I do think now that it puts extreme pressure on the United States to do more. We are arming the opposition now. We do have more confidence that what we're doing is going to the right places for the right reasons. But, you know, the big problem in the Syria situation is Russia. I mean, the rockets that the preliminary reports are that these were rockets that are provided by the Russians that carried potentially this lethal gas. If the facts turn out to be the way the initial reporting indicates, then we've got a real issue with Russia. And I think that is of great concern to our country and to our national security. And I think it's something that Secretary Kerry is going to have to spend a lot of time on. He's been busy trying to re-up the peace process in Israel, which would be a key to stabilization in the entire Middle East if we could get something done there, because that's been a straw man for a lot of the unrest all over the region. But this stuff is all very, very difficult. And it's not like we're real popular over there. I think it's hard for Americans to really digest that the fact that we went and did what we did in Iraq and the fact that we're in Afghanistan and we're helping under our consideration, that would be, well, look, we're trying to do the right thing. We're using our treasure and our blood and our might as a nation for good. I'm not sure that it's appreciated like Americans would want it to be, and we are not. So the involvement of the West directly sometimes makes our enemies more powerful. And that's what the calculation is, that's something you got to think around the corner and not just in a straight line.
Let's bring it back home because we have a limited amount of time here. I wanted to get your take on where you are with Senator Gillibrand now on the sex abuse situation in the military. You two are at some there's some divergence in the way you want to handle this thing. How is this ultimately going to turn out, do you think?
Well, I think that we together have fashioned historic reforms, and there is going to be a long list of them that will be enacted into law. Together, we have forced the Pentagon to acknowledge the status quo is not acceptable, and there's big changes going on in the Pentagon right now. Long overdue, but nonetheless, it's happening. And it will have the force of law behind it before the end of the year. We have one disagreement over one point. It's an honest disagreement. It's whether or not we will have more prosecutions or less prosecutions if you take the chain of command completely out of the process. I believe the only way you're going to hold the chain of command accountable is to make sure that they stay responsible in some way. She believes that somehow victims are going to be more protected if lawyers a half a continent away are making a decision to go forward on a case. I disagree with that. I think if a victim is returning to their unit, they have much more protection when the commander is signed off, and that's not been our problem. It hasn't been the commanders won't sign off on going forward. In fact, they're signing off more often than the lawyers want to go to trial. So that's not where the issue is now. The issue is them meddling after the fact with the results of the case. And in the countries that have taken the commanders completely out, you've not seen any increase in reporting. So if we're doing this just to increase reporting, we can look to the other countries that have done it and realize it hasn't been effective in that regard.
Yeah. Other issues, there are so many to talk about. When you get back to Washington, going back in, what, 2 weeks or so, something like that?
Right, will it 2 weeks.
Well, obviously, there's some big issues you have to face as soon as you get back. We're talking about the potential for a government shutdown and economic issues that have divided the Congress throughout. Where is this going to take us, in your perspective?
Well, I do think there are a number of Republicans in the Senate that understand that we have to compromise. I've got some of my colleagues that don't think we can cut another dime from the budget. They're wrong. I've got some colleagues that think the government is the enemy, and the sooner we bring it to its knees, the better. They are wrong. And it is, in fact, we need to have a glide path to less spending. We do need to do some entitlement reform because it's a demographic detonation that's going to occur in many of our entitlement programs over the next 20 years. So I want us to come to the table and compromise. And I think the looming possibility of a government shutdown will help us do that. I wish we didn't need a crisis to get us to be reasonable. But over the last several years, that's what it's taken.
The Republicans are saying to the Democrats, we told you so with regard to the sequester, that it hasn't been as painful and wouldn't be. They said initially it wouldn't be as painful as your party was saying it would be. Aren't they right?
Well, there has been the initial sequester, but keep in mind the sequester doesn't stop if we don't do something. And I guarantee you this region has already felt the economic ripples of Scott Air Force Base. They would feel even more from Boeing and all of the contractors in this area, to say nothing of what would happen around Fort Leonard Wood and Whiteman Air Force Base if these sequesters go along unabated. And it will have no more CDBG, community development block grants. I'm going to a meeting tomorrow with the Chamber of Commerce in St. Joe, and the list of things they want to talk to me about are all things that are going to be dramatically. In fact, most of them will be zeroed out. If the sequester is allowed to go on without us looking at those things that make sense in terms of our investment. I am somebody, listen, I was campaigned against earmarks, and I believe we can spend less money in the federal government. And I'm working on it every day, ways to do that. But we need to do it with some precision and not with a, you know, with a scalpel and not with a 2x4. And this 2x4 is going to have an impact. In fact, we know that, the sequester has reduced our GDP by almost a full point since it first kicked in. And that's thousands of jobs. And ultimately, if we keep doing what is planned to be done with the sequester, and most of the Republicans now, they acknowledge it, especially when it comes to defense spending. They have a little difficulty with some of the domestic spending.
Is the Affordable Care Act in any trouble?
Well, it is in trouble in states where there has been every attempt to make sure it fails.
Like Missouri.
Like Missouri, where the Missouri legislature is actually saying to Missourians, we're going to take your federal tax dollars and we're going to send them to another state. It is frankly unbelievable to me what they're doing. This is a state legislature that says they don't want anybody to interfere with freedom. They don't want government involved. But yet they are requiring licensure for somebody to help explain to someone where they can go and get health insurance. It's almost as if they think it's very, very important politically for this to fail. And the irony of that is if it doesn't fail, it's affordable and accessible health care for hundreds and thousands of more Missourians. And I don't know how it got to this point, that this became some political litmus test, so you can't be a real Republican unless you want Obamacare to fail more than the next Republican. But that seems to be what the sentiment is in Jefferson City. I wish Missouri voters would truly understand what's going to happen to our hospitals, to people who deserve to be able to have a state-based exchange where they can go buy insurance on the private market. They're going to force all Missourians to go to the federal government to buy their insurance now because they're refusing to set up a local exchange. It's some of it is surreal. It's so bizarre.
And a lot of money being lost in the process.
Billions. Billions of dollars are being denied Missourians, money they paid into the government because of the stubborn political position of the majority in Jefferson City.
We had some business people in the other day on this program, and they were saying that some polls that they've taken showing that 60% of small business is in favor of the Affordable Care Act, unlike some of the things that we've been reading, that they're just going to revolt against the whole thing.
I think people forget why we did this. The reason this happened is because more and more small businesses were having to no longer give insurance because they couldn't afford it. More and more of those employees were showing up at our emergency rooms getting free care because we don't turn people away in the United States. If you show up at an emergency room and you're in dire condition, we take care of you. And then those costs were being passed on and more small businesses couldn't afford the insurance. So we had a cycle that had to be broken because if we didn't break it, more and more people were going to show up without insurance that we were all going to pay for that had insurance. So I do think, and by the way, most small businesses, they have no requirement to provide it, but they do have some tax benefits if they do.
A number of people are calling right now, and most of them are dealing with the same issue, and that's the Westlake landfill. Let's take one of them, and representing all of them, if I may put it that way, Karen in Maryland Heights will take your call to Senator McCaskill. Go ahead.
Hi, Senator. I just have a question for you, and that is, can we expect you, Senator, to stand with our Pattonville Fire Department, the Franciscan Sisters of Mary, and other local organizations such as many of us on the Westlake Landfill Facebook group? I am an admin for that group. I'm asking if we can, if you can call for the removal of the radioactive waste that is at Westlake Landfill.
Well, I certainly will call for anything that will make your neighborhood safe and livable and secure for everyone who lives there. And that's what we have to do. I have met with the regional administrator for the EPA in my office about this. We have, obviously, Senator Blunt and I have both been working together to try to advocate for all of you that feel a great deal of frustration. Part of the problem is that the testing that has done says one thing, and the sense in the neighborhood says the exact opposite. And that's where you've got to push things beyond maybe where the testing would indicate. So I am aware how hard and frustrated, how hard this is for you all and how frustrated you have to be. And I hope I can be helpful.
This has been going on for a long time, and we're talking going back to the days of the Manhattan Project 60, 70 years ago. Why so long?
Well, I think that, you know, first of all, there has been a lot of things that were done in this country before there was much of an environmental conscience. And I think now there's a different set of standards that are in place. But going back, and as you know, Don, we've had a lot of, you know, whether it was the cleanup that had to be done down in southeast Missouri, and we've got, you know, a lot of issues in terms of cleanup that are going on all over the state. And there's a circuit board, former circuit board company that we're working on now. We've got Bannister Mall over in Kansas City where there's issues where there were NSA was working with nuclear material. So, you know, now we don't go ahead with anything that is nuclear without knowing how we're going to handle the waste and how it's going to be responsibly handled. But that wasn't the case 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago.
Any estimates on the cost out at this local landfill?
I do not have an estimate on the cost for you today. But I certainly will pledge to all of your listeners that are worried about this that we will spend a lot of time with them trying to figure out the best way forward for them and their families.
Yeah, as I say, we've had an overwhelming number of calls and
emails.
And tweets.
They're looking for help wherever they can get it.
Sure.
I completely get that.
Well, it's a dangerous situation. There's no question about
it. And it's got to be unsettling to live somewhere where there is that sense of uncertainty.
Let's take another call. Sandra joins us from Bridgeton. Go ahead, Sandra. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm wondering if the Senate or Congress can look into why pharmaceutical companies are suddenly raising prices on drugs that have been around for years. And we're talking cancer drugs, some of them, that have been raised 200-300%. My suspicion is they're doing this to establish a higher price before more people have insurance at the first of the year. And that doesn't sound, well, it certainly doesn't sound ethical. I don't know if it's legal, but it doesn't sound ethical.
Well, we would certainly want to look into the specifics of what you're talking about. I mean, this is the kind of stuff we do all the time. I gleefully accept the responsibility to hold people accountable, particularly when it's some kind of consumer protection issue. So if you would call my office here in St. Louis and let them know that we visited on the phone, on the radio, and get the specific drugs that you're seeing the increase in, and then we will track down whether there's an issue there with a patent or a generic. Sometimes they do this right before a drug goes generic because they're trying to milk every last bit out of it that they can before the drug becomes a generically available drug. But be happy to take a look at the specifics of those and see if we can't rattle some cages.
Are there enough federal controls on big pharma in this country? It occurs to a lot of people, I'm sure, that this does tend to run out of control with what they can charge.
Well, I think it's outrageous that when they passed Part D, they put in there a prohibition that we couldn't negotiate with pharmaceuticals for lower prices. Can you imagine, you know, how many drugs the government buys? We are a huge consumer of pharmaceutical products in this country. Whether it's the VA does negotiate, but many of our hospitals, many of our prisons, you know, we need to be able to negotiate for lower prices based on volume. And that was strictly prohibited. Interestingly enough, the House member that led the Medicare D fight became the number one official for the pharma organization. very soon after that, I don't think that was an accident.
That sort of thing seems to happen a lot. Mentioning the VA, is the VA doing a good job in dealing with returning vets? We get a lot of complaints here from veterans that is not the case. That being that they are not doing a good job, long delays, unresponsive to these people. You're close to this.
Yes. I will say overall, the service at our VA hospitals in Missouri has improved since the time I've been in the Senate. And we know that because we take customer satisfaction surveys in our VA hospitals in Missouri. There has been an improvement. Having said that, the processing of claims, there is a backup. Now, there's a reason. There's good news and bad news about the backup. The backup really ballooned when Secretary Shinseki said anyone who was in Vietnam can make a claim for Agent Orange. So imagine the number of claims that all of a sudden arrived at their doorstep. Now, you cannot make a decision opening up the gates like that without a corresponding increase in personnel to handle it. So they are now working very hard to surge the personnel around VA claims to address the backlog. I know that they're working on it, and it's something that we're trying to monitor. We handle a lot of veterans case files. We certainly welcome them. If you are a veteran and you're struggling with your case file, don't hesitate to call our office.
Our time is starting to get away from us. There's one thing I wanted to bring up, and this may have occurred before you came home for the for this particular, you don't like to call it a recess. It's a working trip. I know that's what you like. But I'm thinking of this rodeo clown business at the state fair. Were you back home when that happened?
I was.
Yeah. I was curious as to what you were thinking about that and how you explain something like that to your colleagues.
Well, I think it's unfortunate in that, listen, if anyone has a right to say whatever they want about President Obama in America, but this was a public event funded by taxpayer dollars, and it wasn't as simple as just having his mask on a dummy. It was taunting and exciting the crowd about hurting him and running him over. And, you know, this is supposed to be for families, and there is a certain amount of respect the presidency deserves. And it felt like that event was derogatory to our respect for the presidency in this country. So I believe I would have been just as offended if it had occurred in the same way with someone pretending that they were a President Reagan or President Bush. I don't think you should taunt a crowd into cheering for physical violence to the President of the United States at a public event. Now, if you want to have a barbecue in your backyard, and you want to, you know, and you don't take any taxpayer and pay your money for it, then, you know, this is America. Go for it. But at that kind of event, I thought it was depressing and sad that some of the families that were there found it very unpatriotic.
Going to have to leave it at that. I will ask you, when you go back, your priority when you go back is to do what?
To get the sexual assault reforms enacted into law, and to make sure that we continue to spend less federal money, but do it in a way that preserves our investment in higher education and infrastructure in this country.
It's plenty to do.
Plenty to do.
Senator Claire McCaskill, thank you so much for being with us.
Great to be
Enjoy
here.
Enjoy the rest of this stay in the Show Me State, if
thank
you will.
Thank you.
Coming up, slavery and Thomas Jefferson. He was against it, except when he was for it. We'll explain in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.